Hi, this is Daniel Jalkut.
And this is Manton Reese.
And this is Core Intuition, unusually dedicated to my craft. Manton Reese, you have transformed yourself from a person who doesn't even use Twitter anymore to counting yourself among their illustrious owners. So you're a shareholder in Twitter Inc.
Well, it's just like what you said, right? Now I can go to the shareholder meetings and I can demand better
demand
API
change.
Support. Yeah, I mean, when we talked last week, I'm like, there's no way I'm going to buy Twitter stock. But then I kind of got into my head that, yeah, maybe it'd be fun to own just like a one token share, just as like a, you know, Twitter is interesting. It's different. And, you know, maybe it'd be neat to just to kind of represent like my involvement with Twitter from the early days and building apps for it. So I did. It turns out in one of our IRA accounts, I had a little bit of cash, like literally like $50, just kind of sitting there on the side. And so I put in a buy order, $50 limit, and it opened at $45. And so I got a single share, which I've now lost $3 on because it's already down a little bit.
I was actually kind of hoping to, you know, I guess it's either unlucky or lucky, depending on how you look at it, that I didn't have money in my trading account. Because mm-hmm. I was kind of like, it was one of those things that caught me off guard, like, oh, maybe I would like to buy some Twitter shares. And I wouldn't have just bought one share, I think, if I had my wits about me. But
this was not an investment. This, to be clear, because someone commented, I think, on one of your tweets, like, you know, now Manton supports and believes in the company or to invest or whatever. And this is just for fun. I'm not going to sell the share. I'm not going to, you know, I just have it.
Well, I do like the idea of you being able to use this token share to go to like a shareholder meeting. You'd be like, management team doing to serve the needs of people who refuse to use Twitter.
You know, there was a great article. Goodness, I'm forgetting where it was now, but they were talking about how it was going through the progression of CEOs that Twitter has had. And at one point they were talking about how the board meetings had gotten out of control. Like there are all these people that weren't on the board just showing up. And so one of the things they did when they were sort of riding the ship was like, cut everybody out and get the board kind of on track. And so that would be me, right? I'm just like in the back of the board meeting, like no one knows what I'm doing there.
Yep. Well, Manton, while you're busy investing in Twitter, Twitter has been busy investing in its infrastructure with their newly announced custom timelines.
Yeah, this is a big feature. And it's interesting to me because it's basically what I built Tweet Library for 3 years ago. Like I had this idea where you could curate and create custom collections and then publish them. And so I love that feature. It's very similar to what Twitter's done. It's also very similar to, you know, Storify and some other services that have come and gone over the years. Curated By was another one. There's a couple other, I'm forgetting their names, but Storify is the big one that people think about.
Right.
And it's a big feature. I requested API access, but it's not totally public. You kind of have to ask permission, and we'll see how
public,
it rolls out.
It's public for everybody but Manton Reese.
Probably so. Yeah. They have a special form just for me when they see my username. No, so they rolled it out in an interesting way. TweetDeck, which is their sort of pro Twitter app that they acquired, has support for it. And then presumably they'll start rolling it out, you know, on twitter.com. But I think it's an important feature. It's a big thing. Like I said, I mean, that's the whole reason I built Tweet Library is to be able to collect tweets together. And so to have it as part of the core platform, I think is really important and it's a good feature.
Yeah.
Twitter hasn't added features, honestly, very much over the last couple of years, a few years. And so it's a big deal. And I would love if third parties could have access to it.
Well, right, because it's the kind of thing, it's so infrastructural that really whatever Tweet Library offers it doesn't matter that if Twitter happens to implement the technology aspect of it, because what you're offering with Tweet Library is just the UI interface to all that collected information, right?
Yeah, and I'll have to think, if they give me access, which I don't know, we'll see how it goes, but if they give me access, I Willis, I'll have to figure out how it would work, right? Because it kind of mirrors what I already have with custom collections in the app. And so one approach would be scrap what I have and just use their API only. But another approach would be keep what I have, but have like a, you know, publish to Twitter feature. Like now I already have a publish feature, which goes to my own website where people can publish tweets. I also have a feature where I can publish to Storify. So it publishes up to there. So I could have another one that published it to a custom timeline on Twitter. So, I mean, I have to think about the right way to handle it, but there's certainly some options.
So I haven't read extensively about this. Is your impression of this that basically every tweet still goes to like the poster's main timeline, but then it can also be a member of these other custom timelines? Or can you have a tweet that's strictly part of a custom timeline and never even goes to the main timeline?
Oh, I just assumed that it would have to go to the main timeline first before it was collected, because that's the way, like I said, my stuff and the way Storify works.
Right.
I don't know. I haven't actually played with it yet. I don't use TweetDeck. I guess I should download it and play with it. But I have to assume that's the way it works. Ads are how Twitter, that's how their business works. So they put promoted tweets in a timeline. Will they put promoted tweets in the custom timelines? I don't know. But it seems like it's in their best interest if tweets flow out in the normal timeline first.
Right. I guess it's just like, it's a pretty big change when you consider, I always think of Twitter as kind of like, they have that aesthetic of simplicity that like Google was so famous for with, you know, the original search homepage. And it's just kind of like, when in doubt, like the answer is no, you're not going to add another feature. You're not going to add another bit of UI. And obviously over the past, you know, over the past 7 years or whatever, but really more and more in the past year or so, they've been adding a lot of new, not to contradict you, you said there hasn't been a lot of new features, but they're like really opening up what it means to try to kind of use Twitter, right? Like, and I guess this is an example of that, you know, like they, with the advertising, that was obviously a big thing, but then, this just makes me appreciate, because like back in the day, it was just like, I had this clear vision of what Twitter's sort of like database might look like. And like, it's just a bunch of tweets, right? It's just,
right.
And I guess it still is, but now this is a whole new, like, presumably, you know, this whole new kind of like, you know, conceptually a table of like these timelines that anybody, I guess, can have as many as they want.
And yeah, I don't know. I assume so.
I mean, it sounds like you could, it sounds like I could make a timeline that has all of your tweets in it. Or, you know, maybe there are limits on it, but
yeah, I mean, you'd have to add the manual, I think, though. I don't think there's an automatic way to set that up. So it's interesting. I still feel like it's consistent with side of the core Twitter experience. And maybe that's also because I've built features like this before. So it feels like a natural thing to do.
Yeah.
I think you're right, though, that Twitter, I mean, the thing they always got right, and I criticize them for a bunch of stuff, but the thing they got right is the simplicity. And if you look at what Twitter was, not in the very first days when it was just like SMS pretty much, but like the first kind of real version of the website, and you compare that to now, it's conceptually hasn't changed that much versus a lot of sites. Facebook, you know, if you look at it years ago compared to now, I mean, it's almost unrecognizable, right? There's a whole bunch of other junk on Facebook. So I think Twitter has done a pretty good job of keeping it fairly simple, even as they roll out things. Because it's all stuff within a tweet, right? Pictures in line within a tweet. Ads are tweets. It's all pretty consistent.
I guess this new custom timelines is kind of like custom timelines are to tweets what, you know, the lists are to users, right? Like we already have this like ability to create infinite or, you know, relatively infinite numbers of lists of different users, right? So I guess this is kind of extending that same idea, saying you can, because, you know, like users is like conceptually this just like list of in the database, but then when they gave this idea of lists, it says, oh, I can make a list that's just Manton and Daniel, and a list that's Manton and Wolf Wrench, and a list that's Craig Hockenberry. And now we have all the people who have ever been on Core Intuition.
Yeah. And lists are weird, and they haven't really supported them very well, I guess. Like, they've slowly... I think they're actually, in the first version, there was kind of a limit on that. You said infinite, but I think it was limited, and they increased that. But it's... Lists are kind of a weird off-to-the-side thing that doesn't... I think the custom timelines will prove to be a lot more popular than lists, actually. And there's stuff about lists that aren't obvious. Like you just said, you create a list with me and you and Craig and Bull French. And, for example, one of the things is, like, you don't... If you have a list like that, you don't see any replies that aren't replies to those four people, right? So there's weird side effects to lists that are...
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe a little confusing.
Well, we'll have to see how this plays out. I do hope that Twitter gives you access to the API. It seems like, you know, this is one of these many little nuanced things that Twitter keeps doing to keep you in the game, Manton. they go public to get you to buy stock. They add compelling new API features, and it's just all leading you down the garden path to getting back on the service within 5 years, and I win the bet.
Well, see, you're still with that 5 years thing. I don't know. We'll see. I mean, it could go either way, right? Because they could deny access, and then I would be.
Oh, that'll
upset.
Just be like, that'll just solidify it.
Well, also, I mean, like, I keep bringing up Storify because every single press coverage of this so far is compared to Storify. But it's actually kind of interesting because if you go back to that old, you know, quadrant thing from a year ago or so. Where it's like, we want certain kinds of apps in these quadrants.
Right.
You know what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah. And then there was the quadrant corner that was like all of the apps that we loved.
Right.
That was like the bad corner.
Storify was in that bad corner.
Right.
But it was actually called out as a good example. Like, they did want apps like Storify. They clarified later. But I found it interesting because I went back today to that blog post announcing all these API changes. And we'll link to it in the show notes, but it's interesting to look at that and then now look at today. And I like to hope that Twitter, in their sort of exclusive list of people that have had access to this beta API, I like to hope that Storify and those apps have had access.
Yeah.
But if I were cynical, you know, I would say they didn't have access, and then this is Twitter sort of...
Yeah.
They said they wanted those kind of apps, and then a year later, they're sort of Sherlocking it, I guess.
You're right. They either Sherlock it or just buy a tweet deck they just bought, right? So
true. But anyway, I think it's an important feature, and even though I'm not posting on Twitter, I'm excited that they're doing something like this because I do think it's very valuable, and it will have a huge reach compared to. I mean, I love what I've built in Tweet Library, but I mean, let's face it, I have hardly any users compared to the 200 million. Twitter users or whatever. So it will have a huge reach and it will be really useful to a lot of people.
Yeah. You've got some work to do, Manton, in building up that user base. So good luck to you on that. Okay. Well, folks, we are very happy to have back as sponsors of the show this week, Crashlytics. And Crashlytics, you're probably familiar with them by now, but if you haven't started logging your crashes and taking responsibility for the behavior of your app out in the wild, it's really time to start doing that, and Crashlytics makes it really easy to do. You just download their SDK. It makes it really easy, really smooth to install their SDK, their framework into your app. You build it. You ship it up to Apple in your next release, and you will see crashes coming in real time as customers run into them. It's really a smooth interface. I have used it a little bit, as I mentioned on past shows, with my Shush iOS app. Manton, of course, has used it quite a bit more. He's got, you know, real iOS app shipping, unlike me. And it's been working pretty well for you, right, Manton?
Yeah, it has. Yeah, as I've said on the show, I've used it in Tweet Library for a long time. Also, I haven't mentioned, but I just realized that I've also been using it. My regular job, I work at a company during the day doing ebook software, right? And so we've actually had it in Crashlytics in the iOS app and in our Android app. So this is another thing. On the show, sometimes we talk about, you know, it supports iOS and Android. And when I say that, sometimes I think our listeners don't care about Android, but no, actually a lot of them support both platforms. So it's useful to have it on both. But one of the things that we found really valuable is this custom logging stuff and the ability to search it as well, which is new. So, like, for example, if in a ebook reader, you can imagine there might be a crash when someone's reading a book. Well, you could log like the ISBN for that book or some other identifier for that book when it crashes. And then if there's any content issues, there's anything in particular about that book that made your app crash, or maybe it's not a book, maybe it's some other kind of content, then that's logged with the crash and it's searchable and you can look it up and see, okay, there's something special about this content. So we've been doing that with books. Maybe for your app, listeners out there, there's something similar where that you have a little bit of data, you know, that you can expose in the crash and make it just a little bit easier to find out what went wrong. So Crashlytics still working really well. And thanks for sponsoring the show. You can learn more at crashlytics.com. It's free. Sign up and give it a try.
Now, that's a really good example, Manton, with the ISBN, because you could potentially have like thousands of different books, right? And then being able to then search on, like you start noticing these crashes coming and being able to search on, oh, I wonder if anybody else has been crashing while reading this book, right? And then suddenly Your monumental task of figuring out what's going on is much easier.
Exactly.
Once again, thanks Crashlytics for sponsoring the show. And as Manton just said, you can learn more at crashlytics.com. Well, Manton, I have been unusually dedicated to my craft this past week or two, and I've been missing all these news announcements, and I haven't been paying as close attention to Twitter, and I've been skipping meals and not conducting myself in a hygienic manner, and all this stuff, just because I've just been sort of like knee deep at first, and then maybe neck deep, and then maybe over my head with auto layout and various thrills and challenges that come with adopting that technology. So I keep like days keep going by and I keep looking up from my desk and sort of realizing that I have made some incremental progress. But the funny thing is, I'm really having a great time. Like I'm in an unusually good mood about my work, and you wouldn't think that that would be creditable to day after day of frustration with auto layout. But let's just say, so this is an example. You and I, Manton, have talked about this before. Technologies that Daniel and Manton spend years not adopting and then finally pick up.
Yep.
And auto layout, I have known since day one just how interested I was in it because of all of the promise it has for things like localization, just making your layout more, adaptable and flexible. You know, let's face it, like those of us who have designed layouts or just had to implement layouts in code, there's some extent to which our inability as a programmer has prevented us from making the UI do what we would ideally like it to do. Mm-hmm. And I have a bunch of code in Mars Edit that's like trying desperately to achieve things that I think are good, you know, dynamic reshuffling of views and moving stuff around. And, you know, a lot of stuff, like for example, in Mars Edit, when you switch from one blog to another, like there may be totally different features. Like if you switch from Tumblr to WordPress, the UI for the post editor has to kind of change itself. Mm-hmm. And all of that stuff right now is this really monstrous, like manual removal and additions of views and setting up all the frames and saying, okay, well, if this view is here, then this one should be a few pixels over from that. And because we just added a new photo field for Tumblr, we have to grow the window by the same number of pixels to.
Yeah.
And that's like, I've just described like what auto layout is designed to solve.
Right. And it puts all that off into one place. So it's not just kind of like annoyingly littered throughout other parts of the code.
Yeah. And it's like the key word that people, you know, use to describe the difference of how auto layout works is that it's declarative layout as opposed to programmatic layout. I don't know what you call the alternative, but it's nice because you say where you want the views, you say how you want the views to behave with respect to one another instead of literally saying where they should go. And this does have a learning curve, a huge, huge learning curve, but it's been a really, really fun learning curve. Is this something, is this something you've worked with at all yet?
I have. I don't know about the fun part. I mean, my first impression, I think, is a lot, you know, like a lot of developers, I would try it, things wouldn't work, and then I would give up and go back to the old way. And I have slowly started using it more, but mostly actually in Interface Builder. So Xcode 5 has way better support for this stuff than ever before. And so I feel like that's helped me a lot start to slowly enable auto layout in more places. And so in my new app, Sunlit, the auto layout is scattered throughout. It's not 100%, but maybe half or maybe a little less than half, honestly, of the UI uses auto layout. And unfortunately, I'm still not past that. You know, I'm not up to the fun part yet. I'm still in the frustration part. So I do often give up and just go back to the old way where, you know, I'm trying to make a feature work and I'm not as patient as you are. And so after hitting my head against the wall for a little bit, I sometimes give up. But eventually I think I'll cross over into that point where auto layout is easier and obviously it's more powerful and flexible.
Yeah, well, I can certainly appreciate now why people have been so frustrated by it, you know, over the past few years, because especially if you come at it from with a perspective of being comfortable with the old way of doing things, with like springs and struts and with setting frames on things, like anything you try to do with setting frames on things is going to be like throwing a rubber ball at a wall and letting it bounce back and hit you. It's just like, it's just not the way to do it. I think the reason I'm having fun and not just being like pissed off and frustrated all the time is because when it comes down to it, every time I get stuck and every time I'm, you know, sort of muddling my way through trying to figure out how to get something to work, it's because of a deficiency in my understanding and not a deficiency in the promise of the framework, right? So I hate that. I hate when I'm working on some code and it's just like, you know, this such and such, like, you know, framework view doesn't do what it promised. And that's like the worst. It's like, you know, this token field doesn't, you know, behave the way that the documentation says it should. And I think with auto layout, the more I use it, the more I'm like, well, you know, even the things that I have found that I thought might be defects, there's like some weird logic to them. And it's like, oh, I see. So it's more about, I think the reason it's fun is it's more like this elaborate puzzle to work my way through.
Yeah.
And especially in the context of having an existing app with such a complex view hierarchy, I'm just like, how do I get this to the next step, you know? And maybe I'll still like run into something where I'm so frustrated, I'll just get mad and I won't be having fun anymore. But so far it's been good. I think also I see that light at the end of the tunnel where it's like, oh, I will be like able to do such flexible things with this.
Yeah. And I think you're right that the framework is mature and robust. And it's like I talked a second ago about Xcode 5 getting better in terms of being able to control these things from the UI. But the auto layout has been around for a while now. And in fact, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, I think it started in Carbon, right? Like the HI Toolbox stuff.
I don't know about that. That sounds like crazy talk to me.
I think so. I think the HI Toolbox stuff started, you know, like the ASCII way to do constraints and stuff. Pretty sure that started in Carbon and then went to Cocoa like the following year. Listeners can jump in if I'm wrong, but that's my memory of things from WWDC. And so it's been around for years now and it's mature and it's really powerful. But the tool support has been catching up. And I think that's where a lot of people have been tripped up also. But so how are you approaching it? Are you doing everything in code? How are you tackling when you're looking at a view in Mars Edit and you want to convert it to auto layout? What's your process?
I have done a little of both. I try when possible to do stuff in Interface Builder now, because like you said, in Xcode 5, it's a lot better. And I never even tried to use it. The only time I ever used it in Xcode 4 was when I accidentally created a new nib and it was on by default. And I was like, what the hell is going on here? But in Xcode 5, so my only real experience using it is with Xcode 5. And I'm certainly frustrated by some of the UI limitations. Like if you have a lot of constraints, for example, on a view, it can be very easy to lose track of like which ones apply to which subviews, et cetera. But you're right, it makes it a lot easier to work with. So when I can, I try to, you know, do the constraints in Interface Builder. But, you know, like just before we started recording this today, I was working on this this problem I have where I basically have this view that accepts an arbitrary number of subviews that have to be ordered by this kind of like strict ordering policy I have. This is, for perspective, this is like the fields at the top of a blog post, similar to what you would see in mail for the like to CC and blind CC and stuff fields. Mm-hmm. So that kind of stuff, I also support, you know, dynamically user defined fields. And so I can't just put everything in a nib. So that I'm figuring out how to work with all from code. And I think this is sort of like a level up with auto layout and constraints, is when you start grouping collections of constraints together in a way that you can like remove them and then rebuild and re-add them to the view or to the window. So like I have like this collection of constraints that just like all apply to the order of these subviews in the view. And then like if there's some reason they need to be reordered, I can just like toss those out and add new constraints. That's basically the way I've been going at it. Has involved me getting comfortable with Interface Builder, but also getting comfortable at a code level. Also, a lot of the learning curve for me has been coming up with new techniques for, you know, printing out debugging information about constraints.
Right. Yeah, that sounds like something that would really help me, is to be able to debug this stuff a little better so I wouldn't give up if I ran into constraint problems. And sometimes in IB, you can set things up where your app will basically just blow up, at least on iOS. Like if things are, it just can't resolve the constraints, it just kind of gives up. And it would be nice to be able to debug that stuff a little bit better rather than, because what I generally do if I run into some problem is I just reset everything and rebuild the constraints. And be nice to know a little more about why those things aren't working. And that's just my inexperience with the API.
So like my sort of like methodical technique for debugging something is like if I see something in a Mars Edit window that doesn't look like it's in the right place, first of all, I have as part of my debugging setup, I have all of my apps install FScript Anywhere. You're familiar with that?
Yeah.
And then that gives me the ability at any time to jump into the FScript inspector and then click on a view and like look at information about it. So I can look at information about a view, including things like does it have, you know, what's its frame, you know, what's its super views frame. And then I can take the address of that view and go hop back into Xcode, into the debugger console, and call the methods. There's some debugging methods like constraints affecting layout on this axis. So I have these little shortcuts now where I can say like, okay, given this view, it's not where I think it should be. What are all the constraints that are affecting it? And then you can even do stuff like going in with FScript Anywhere and like remove constraints, or you can kind of do some live tweaking. You know, sometimes I do that from the console in the debugger. I say like, you can force it to update its constraints. You can force it to do the layout again. It's basically, I have to admit, it is pretty much a black hole of of learning, you know, how to cope with this stuff. But like I said, I feel like it's kind of like you either accept that it's part of the future or not. And I think some developers out there, no discredit to them, but some developers are deciding that it is not part of their future. They're just going to stick with springs and struts going forward. But I'm worried that if I did that, I would be limiting myself from, you know, how great the UI can really be.
Yeah, I think it's useful. It's not the sort of leveling up feature of like core animation or something just that would be very, very difficult to build the same kinds of user interfaces without it. But I think it's the kind of thing that if you learn it, everything becomes easier later.
Yeah.
And you'll obviously be able to build better UI features more quickly. There, you might build something that before would be, oh, I don't want to hide these controls or slide these out in a certain way because I know it's going to have all this tedious, you know, basically CG rect math just to figure out exactly where these views go. But if you're already totally comfortable with auto layout, you might be able to just dive into that and just implement it easier.
Yeah, there's also an element in my view. I see, especially getting into this and seeing how Apple has designed so much around auto layout, I see springs and struts as almost a deprecated technology.
Right.
And I heard, and I don't know for sure if this is true, but I heard that on iOS, auto layout is actually always in effect. And that, you know, because, you know, there's this compatibility mode that goes that is available where all of your springs and struts are automatically adapted to auto layout because it's like a subset of what auto layout can do. And I heard that on iOS, that's embraced so heavily that even if you don't think you're using auto layout, you are.
Right. And if you don't set any, if you don't set any constraints, it automatically makes the right ones for you at runtime, right? And maybe that's similar to what you're saying.
Yes. Oh, but on Mac OS X still, at least, you know, as of now with Xcode 5 and Mac OS 10.9, none of your windows go into auto layout mode until there is at least one constraint on something.
Okay.
And so if you don't, on Mac OS X, if you don't install any constraints and if, you know, Apple's views don't install any constraints, then the window, it's strictly using the old techniques, the old resize subviews techniques that use auto layout or auto sizing flags.
Right.
I could see Apple, since it sounds like they've already done that on iOS, I think the only reason that they haven't done it on Mac OS X is there's just a lot more complicated view stuff out there with weird timing issues and stuff like that. So
it's just like Apple to eventually not necessarily force people to, but to strongly encourage people to move to the new way of doing things.
Yep.
Whenever there's a chance with some sort of API compatibility thing or whatever, having to adapt to some new API, they'll push you that direction.
Yeah. Oh, I think what's key about auto layout, one of the reasons I'm having fun and one of the reasons I'm not just frustrated by it is because I'm so satisfied by the idea of this being the approach to laying out user interfaces that I'm already like thinking like I need to go get something like this for my website, you know, like my I don't want to do whatever, you know, CSS layout anymore. I want to do auto layout for the web. And what's interesting is that, so you said you thought this goes back to HI Toolbox, and it may very well have some roots there, but I had also read that it's based on some academic work, and that academic work was realized as well in JavaScript. So that's something I want to go check out and see, you know, if there's a JavaScript web-based version of this, I might switch my website to it.
Yeah, I think when this came up before, I said you're just procrastinating building your new website stuff. It's that classic, you know, when the perfect technology arrives, I will do something.
5 months from now, when everybody's still asking, where's Mars Edit for iOS, I will be just finishing up my auto layout conversion for Mac OS X.
Well, cool. Good luck finishing that. I think it sounds like you are very far along and you will have a nice, more flexible UI in your app when you're all done.
I think so. I'm excited about it. And wish you luck in getting your access to custom timelines on Twitter.
Thanks. And thanks, everybody, for listening to the show this week. And we'll talk to you next time.